someone like Sir, or you.
Me? When I had two hands. Jamie did not delude himself. Sandor would make short work of him now. You have a name?
Rafford, if it pleases. Most call me Raff.
Raff, gather the garrison together in the Hall of 100 Hearths. Your captives as well. I want to see them. Those whores from the crossroads, too. Oh, and Holt. I was distraught to hear that he had died. I'd like to look upon his head. When they brought it to him, he found that the goat's lips had been sliced off, along with his ears and most of his nose. The crows had supped upon his eyes. It was still recognizably Holt, however. Jamie would have known his beard anywhere, an absurd rope of hair 2 feet long, dangling from a pointed chin. Elsewise, only a few leathery strips of flesh still clung to the Cahoric skull. "Where is the rest of him?" he asked. No one wanted to tell him. Finally, Shitmouth lowered his eyes and muttered,
"Rotted, sir. And et."
"One of the captives was always begging food," Rafford admitted. "So, sir said to give him roast goat. The Cahoric didn't have much meat on him, though. Sir took his hands and feet first, then his arms and legs. The fat bugger got most, my lord," Shitmouth offered. "But, sir, he said to see that all the captives had a taste, and oat, too, his own self. That Orson had slubber when we fed him, and the grease had run down into that skinny beard of his."
"Father," Jamie thought, "your dogs have both gone mad." He found himself remembering tales he had first heard as a child at Castle Rock, of mad Lady Lulston, who bathed in tubs of blood and presided over feasts of human flesh within these very walls. Somehow revenge had lost its savour. "Take this and throw it in the lake." Jamie tossed Holt's head to Peck and turned to address the garrison. "Until such time as Lord Peter arrives to claim his seat, Sir Bonifer Hasty shall hold Harrenhall in the name of the crown. Those of you who wish may join him, if he'll have you. The rest will ride with me to River Run." The mountain's men looked at one another.
"We're owed," said one. "Sir promised us rich rewards," he said.
"His very words," Shitmouth agreed. "Rich rewards for them as rides with me."
A dozen others began to yammer their assent. Sir Bonifer raised a gloved hand.
"Any man who remains with me shall have a hide of land to work, a second hide when he takes a wife, a third at the birth of his first child."
"Land, sir?"
Shitmouth spat.
"Piss on that. If we wanted a grub in the bloody dirt, we could have bloody well stayed home. Begging your pardon, sir. Rich rewards, sir said. Meaning gold."
"If you have a grievance, go to King's Landing and take it up with my sweet sister." Jamie turned to Rafford. "I'll see those captives now, starting with Sir Willis Manderley."
"He the fat one?"
asked Rafford. "I devoutly hope so. And tell me no sad stories of how he died, or the lot of you are apt to do the same." Any hopes he might have nursed of finding Shagwell, Pig, or Zola languishing in the dungeons were sadly disappointed. The brave companions had abandoned Varga Holt to a man, it would seem. Of Lady Wendt's people, only 3 remained. The cook who had opened the postern gate for Sir Gregor, a bent-back armourer called Ben Blackthumb, and a girl named Pia, who was not near as pretty as she had been when Jamie last saw her. Someone had broken her nose and knocked out half her teeth. The girl fell at Jamie's feet when she saw him, sobbing and clinging to his leg with hysterical strength, until Strongbore pulled her off. "No one will hurt you now," he told her, but that only made her sob the louder. The other captives had been better treated. Sir Willis Manderley was amongst them, along with several other high-born Northmen taken prisoner by the Mountain That Rides, in the fighting at the fords of the Trident. Useful hostages, all worth a goodly ransom. They were ragged, filthy, and shaggy to a man, and some had fresh bruises, cracked teeth, and missing fingers. but their wounds had been washed and bandaged, and none of them had gone hungry. Jamie wondered if they had any inkling what they had been eating, and decided it was better not to inquire. None had any defiance left, especially not Sir Willis, a bushy-faced tub of suet with dull eyes and sallow, sagging jowls. When Jamie told him that he would be escorted to a maiden pool and there put on a ship for White Harbour, Sir Willis collapsed into a puddle on the floor and sobbed longer and louder than Pierre had. It took four men to lift him back onto his feet. "Too much roast goat," Jamie reflected. "Gods, but I hate this bloody castle." Harrenhal had seen more horror in its 300 years than Castle Rock had witnessed in 3,000. Jamie commanded that fires be lit in the hall of 100 hearths, and sent the cook hobbling back to the kitchens to prepare a hot meal for the men of his column. "Anything but goat." He took his own supper in Hunter's Hall with Sir Bonifer Hasty, a solemn stalk of a man prone to assaulting his speech with appeals to the seven. "I want none of Sir Gregor's followers," he declared, as he was cutting up a pear as withered as he was, so as to make certain that its non-existent juice did not stain his pristine purple doublet, embroidered with the white Ben Cotiste of his house. "I will not have such sinners in my service." "My Septon used to say all men were sinners." "He was not wrong," Sir Bonifer allowed. "But some sins are blacker than others, and fouler in the nostrils of the seven."
"And you have no more nose than my little brother, or my own sins would have you choking on that pear."
"Very well, I'll take Gregor's lot off your hands. He could always find a use for fighters. If nothing else, he would send them up the ladders first, should he need to storm the walls of River Run."
"Take the whore as well," Sir Bonifer urged. "You know the one, the girl from the dungeons."
"Pierre." The last time he had been here, Kyburn had sent the girl to his bed, thinking that would please him. But the Pierre they had brought up from the dungeons was a different creature from the sweet, simple, giggly creature who crawled beneath his blankets. She had made the mistake of speaking when Sir Gregor wanted quiet, so the mountain had smashed her teeth to splinters with a mailed fist and broken her pretty little nose as well. He would have done worse, no doubt, if Cersei had not called him down to King's Landing to face the Red Viper's spear. Jamie would not mourn him. "Pierre was born in this castle," he told Sir Bonifer. "It is the only home she has ever known."
"She is a font of corruption," said Sir Bonifer. "I won't have her near my men, flaunting her parts."
"I expect her flaunting days are done," he said. "But if you find her that objectionable, I'll take her." He could make her a washerwoman, he supposed. His squires did not mind raising his tent, grooming his horse, or cleaning his armour, but the task of caring for his clothes struck them as unmanly. "Can you hold Harrenhal with just your Holy 100? Jamie asked. They should actually be called the Holy 86, having lost 14 men upon the Blackwater. But no doubt Sir Bonifer would fill up his ranks again as soon as he found some sufficiently pious recruits.
"I anticipate no difficulty. The crone will light our way, and the warrior will give strength to our arms."
"Or else a stranger will turn up for the whole holy lot of you." Jamie could not be certain who had convinced his sister that Sir Bonifer should be named Castellan of Harrenhal, but the appointment smelled of Orton Merryweather. Hasty had once served Merryweather's grandsire, he seemed to recall dimly, and the carrot-haired justiciar was just the sort of simple-minded fool to assume that someone called the Good was the very potion the Riverlands required to heal the wounds left by Roose Bolton, Varga Hote, and Gregor Clegane. But he might not be wrong. Hasty hailed from the Stormlands, so had neither friends nor foes along the Trident. No blood feuds, no debts to pay, no cronies to reward. He was sober, just, and dutiful,
and his holy 86 were as well disciplined as any soldiers in the Seven Kingdoms, and made a lovely sight as they wheeled and pranced their tall grey geldings. Littlefinger had once quipped that Sir Bonifer must have gelded the riders too, so spotless was their repute. All the same, Jamie wondered about any soldiers who were better known for their lovely horses than for the foes they'd slain. They pray well, I suppose. But can they fight? They had not disgraced themselves on the Blackwater, so far as he knew, but they had not distinguished themselves either. Sir Bonifer himself had been a promising knight in his youth, but something had happened to him, a defeat or a disgrace or a near brush with death, and afterward he had decided that jousting was an empty vanity and put away his lance for good and all. Harrenhal must be held, though, and Balor Butthole here is the man that Cersei chose to hold it. His castle has an ill repute, he warned him, and one that's well deserved. It said that Harren and his son still walk the halls by night of fire. Those who look upon them burst into flame.
I fear no shade, sir. It is written in the seven-pointed star that spirits, wights, and revenants cannot harm a pious man so long as he is armored in his faith.
Then arm yourself in faith by all means, but wear a suit of mail, and plate as well. Every man who holds this castle seems to come to a bad end, the mountain, the goat, even my father.
If you will forgive my saying so, they were not godly men, as we are. The warrior defends us, and help is always near, if some dread foe should threaten. Maester Gullion will remain with his ravens. Lord Lancel is nearby at Derry with his garrison, and Lord Randall holds Maidenpool. Together we three shall hunt down and destroy whatever outlaws prowl these parts. Once that is done, the seven will guide the good folk back to their villages to plough and plant and build anew.
The ones the goat didn't kill, at least. Jamie hooked his golden fingers round the stem of his wine goblet. If any of Hote's brave companions fall into your hands, send word to me at once. The stranger might have made off with the goat before Jamie could get around to him, but Fat Zola was still out there, with Shagwell, Rorg, Faithful, Urswick, and the rest.
So you can torture them and kill them?
I suppose you would forgive them in my place.
If they made sincere repentance for their sins, yes, I would embrace them all as brothers, and pray with them before I sent them to the block. Sins may be forgiven. Crimes require punishment.
Hasty folded his hands before him like a steeple, in a way that reminded Jamie uncomfortably of his father.
If it is Sandor Clegane that we encounter, what would you have me do?
Pray hard, Jamie thought, and run.
Send him to join his beloved brother, and be glad the guards made seven hells.
One would never be enough to hold both of the Cleganes. He pushed himself awkwardly to his feet. Beric Dondarrion is a different matter. Should you capture him, hold him for my return. I want to march him back to King's Landing with a rope about his neck, and have Sir Ilion take his head off, where half the realm can see.
And this Mearish priest who runs with him. It is said he spreads his false faith everywhere.
Kill him, kiss him, or pray with him as you please.
I have no wish to kiss the man, my lord.
No doubt he'd say the same of you. Jamie's smile turned into a yawn. My pardons. I shall take my leave of you, if you have no objections.
None, my lord, said Hasty.
No doubt he wished to pray. Jamie wished to fight. He took the steps two at a time out to where the night air was cold and crisp. In the torch-lit yard, Strongbore and Sir Flemon Brax were having at each other whilst a ring of men-at-arms cheered them on. Sir Lyle will have the best of that one, he knew. I need to find Sir Ilion. His fingers had the itch again. His footsteps took him away from the noise and the light. He passed beneath the covered bridge and through the flowstone yard before he realized where he was headed. As he neared the bear pit, he saw the glow of a lantern, its pale, wintry light washing over the tiers of steep stone seats. "Someone has come before me," it would seem. The pit would be a fine place to dance. Perhaps Sir Ilion had anticipated him. But the knight standing over the pit was bigger, a husky, bearded man in a red and white surcoat adorned with griffins.
"Conington? What's he doing here?"
Below, the carcass of the bear still sprawled upon the sands, though only bones and ragged fur remained half buried. Jamie felt a pang of pity for the beast. At least he died in battle. "Sir Ronnet," he called, "have you lost your way? It's a large castle, I know." Red Ronnet raised his lantern.
"I wish to see where the bear danced with a maiden not so fair."
His beard shone in the light as if it were a fire. Jamie could smell wine on his breath.
"Is it true that the wench fought naked?"
"Naked, no." He wondered how that wrinkle had been added to the story. "The mummers put her in a pink silk gown and shoved a tawny sword into her hand. The goat wanted her death to be a new thing. Elsewise, the sight of Brian naked might have made the bear flee in terror." Conington laughed. Jamie did not. "You speak as if you know the lady."
"I was betrothed to her."
That took him by surprise. Brian had never mentioned a betrothal. Her father made a match for her?
"Thrice," said Conington. "I was the second. My father's notion. I'd heard the wench was ugly, and I told him so, but he said all women were the same once you blew the candle out."
"Your father?"
Jamie eyed Red Ronnet's surcoat, where two griffins faced each other on a field of red and white.
"Dancing griffins?"
"Our late hand's brother, was he?"
"Cousin. Lord John had no brothers."
"No." It all came back to him. John Conington had been Prince Rhaegar's friend. When Merryweather failed so dismally to contain Robert's rebellion and Prince Rhaegar could not be found, Aerys had turned to the next best thing and raised Conington to their handship. But the Mad King was always chopping off his hands. He had chopped Lord John after the Battle of the Bells, stripping him of honours, lands, and wealth, and packing him off across the sea to die in exile, where he soon drank himself to death. The cousin, though, Red Runnett's father, had joined the rebellion and had been rewarded with Griffin's Roost after the Trident. He only got the castle, though. Robert kept the gold and bestowed the greater part of the Conington lands on more fervent supporters. Sir Ronnet was a landed knight no more. For any such, the Maid of Tarth would have been a sweet plum indeed. "How is it that you did not wed?" Jamie asked him.
"Why, I went to Tarth and saw her. I had 6 years on her, yet the wench could look me in the eye. She was a sow in silk, though most sows are bigger teats. When she tried to talk, she almost choked on her own tongue. I gave her a rose and told her it was all that she would ever have for me."
Conington glanced into the pit.
"The bear was less hairy than that freak. I'll—"
Jamie's golden hand cracked him across the mouth so hard the other knight went stumbling down the steps. His lantern fell and smashed, and the oil spread out, burning. "You are speaking of a high-born lady, sir. Call her by her name. Call her Brian." Conington edged away from the spreading flames on his hands and knees.
"Brian, if it please my lord."
He spat a glob of blood at Jamie's foot.
"Brian, the beauty."
Cersei. It was a slow climb to the top of Visenya's hill. As the horses laboured upward, The Queen leaned back against a plump red cushion. From outside came the voice of Sir Osmond Kettlebeck.
"Make way! Clear the street! Make way for Her Grace the Queen!"
"Marjorie does keep a lively court," Lady Merriweather was saying. "We have jugglers, mummers, poets, puppets, singers," prompted Cersei. "Many and more, Your Grace. Hamish the Harper plays for her once a fortnight, and sometimes Alec of Icen will entertain us of an evening, but the Blue Bard is her favourite."
Cersei recalled the bard from Tommen's wedding. Young and fair to look upon. Could there be something there? "There are other men as well, I hear. Knights and courtiers, admirers. Hear me true, my lady. Do you think Marjorie is still a maiden?"
She says she is, Your Grace."
"So she does. What do you say?"
Tainer's black eyes sparkled with mischief. "When she wed Lorendi at Highgarten, I helped disrobe him for the bidding. His lordship is, he was a well-made man, and lusty. I saw the proof when we tumbled him into the wedding bed where his bride awaited him as naked as her name day, blushing prettily beneath the coverlets. Sir Loras had carried her up the steps himself. Marjorie may say the marriage was never consummated, that Lord Renly had drunk too much wine at the wedding feast. But I promise you, the bit between his legs was anything but weary when last I saw it."
"Did you chance to see the marriage bed the morning after?" Cersei asked. "Did she bleed?"
"No sheet was shown, Your Grace."
"Ah, pity. Still, the absence of a bloody sheet meant little by itself. Common peasant girls bled like pigs upon their wedding nights, she had heard. But that was less true of high-born maids like Marjorie Tyrell. A lord's daughter was more like to give her maidenhead to a horse than a husband, it was said. And Marjorie had been riding since she was old enough to walk. I understand the little queen has many admirers amongst our household knights. The Redwyn twins, Sir Thallard. Who else, pray tell?"
Lady Merriweather gave a shrug. "Sir Lambert, the fool who hides a good eye behind a patch. Bayard Norcross, Courtney Greenhill, the brothers Woodwright, sometimes Portifer, and often Lucantine. Oh, and Grand Mr. Pycelle is a frequent visitor."
"Pycelle? Truly? Had that doddering old worm forsaken the lion for the rose? If so, he will regret it. Who else?"
"The summer islander in his feathered cloak. How could I have forgotten him with his skin as black as ink? Others come to pay court to her cousins. Eleanor is promised to the Ambrose boy, but loves to flirt. And Megger has a new suitor every fortnight. Once she kissed a potboy in the kitchen. I have heard talk of her marrying Lady Bulwer's brother, but if Megger were to choose for herself, she would sooner have Mark Mullendore, I am certain."
Cersei laughed. "The butterfly knight who lost his arm on the Blackwater. What good is half a man?"
"Megger thinks him sweet. She has asked Lady Marjorie to help her find a monkey for him."
"A monkey?" The queen did not know what to say to that. "Sparrows and monkeys? Truly the realm is going mad. What of our brave Sir Loras? How often does he call upon his sister?"
"More than any of the others." When Taina frowned, a tiny crease appeared between her dark eyes. "Every morn and every night he visits, unless duty interferes. Her brother is devoted to her. They share everything with—"
"Oh!" For a moment the Meerish woman looked almost shocked. Then a smile spread across her face.
"I have had a most wicked thought, Your Grace."
"Best keep it yourself. The hill is thick with sparrows, and we all know how sparrows abhor wickedness.
I have heard they abhor soap and water too, Your Grace.
Perhaps too much prayer robs a man of his sense of smell.
I shall be sure to ask His High Holiness. The drapery swung back and forth in a wash of crimson silk.
Orton told me that the High Septon has no name, Lady Tyna said. Can it be true? In Mere, we all have names.
Oh, he had a name once, they all do. The Queen waved a hand dismissively. Even Septons born of noble blood go only by their given name as once they've taken their vows. When one of them is elevated to High Septon, he puts aside that name as well. The Faith will tell you he no longer has any need of a man's name, for he has become the avatar of the gods.
How do you distinguish one High Septon from another?
With difficulty. One has to say the fat one, or the one before the fat one, or the old one who died in his sleep. You can always winkle out their birth names if you like, but they take umbrage if you use them. It reminds them that they were born ordinary men, and they do not like that.
And my lord husband tells me that this new one was born with filth beneath his fingernails.
So I suspect. As a rule, the most devout elevate one of their own, but there have been exceptions.
Grand Maester Purcell had informed her of the history at tedious length.
During the reign of King Balor the Blessed, a simple stonemason was chosen as High Septon. He worked stone so beautifully that Balor decided he was the smith reborn in mortal flesh. Man could neither read nor write, nor recall the words of the simplest of prayers. Some still claimed that Balor's hand had the man poisoned to spare the realm embarrassment. After that one died, an 8-year-old boy was elevated, once more at King Balor's urging. The boy worked miracles, His Grace declared, though even his little healing hands could not save Balor during his final fast. Lady Merriweather gave a laugh.
8 years old? Perhaps my son could be High Septon. He is almost 7.
Does he pray a lot? The Queen asked.
He prefers to play with swords.
A real boy, then. Can he name all 7 gods?
I think so.
I shall have to take him under consideration. Cersei did not doubt that there were any number of boys who would do more honour to the Crystal Crown than the wretch on whom the most devout had chosen to bestow it.
This is what comes of letting fools and cowards rule themselves. Next time I will choose their master for them.
And the next time might not be long in coming, if the new High Septon continued to annoy her. Baylor's hand had little to teach Cersei Lannister where such matters were concerned.
"Clear the way!" Sir Osmond Kettleblack was shouting. "Make way for the Queen's Grace!"
The litter began to slow, which could only mean they were near the top of the hill.
"You should bring this son of yours to court," Cersei told Lady Merriweather. 6 is not too young. Tommen needs other boys about him. Why not your son?"
Geoffrey had never had a close friend of his own age, that she recalled. The poor boy was always alone. I had Jamie when I was a child, and Malara until she fell into the well.
Geoff had been fond of the hound, to be sure, but that was not friendship. He was looking for the father he never found in Robert.
A little foster brother might be just what Tommen needs to wean him away from Margaery and her hens. In time they might grow as close as Robert and his boyhood friend Ned Stark. A fool, but a loyal fool. Tommen will have need of loyal friends to watch his back.
"Your Grace is kind, but Rustler has never known any home but Longtable. I fear he would be lost in this great city."
"In the beginning," the Queen allowed, "but he will soon outgrow that as I did. When my father sent for me to court, I wept, and Jamie raged, until my aunt sat me down in the stone garden and told me there was no one in King's Landing that I need ever fear. 'You are a lioness,' she said, 'and it is for all the lesser beasts to fear you. Your son will find his courage, too.' Surely you would prefer to have him close at hand, where you could see him every day. He is your only child, is he not? For the present, my lord husband has asked the gods to bless us with another son, in case...
I know. She thought of Joffrey, clawing at his neck. In his last moments, he had looked at her in desperate appeal, and a sudden memory had stopped her heart. A drop of red blood, hissing in a candle flame, a croaking voice that spoke of crowns and shrouds, of death at the hands of the Valonqar. Outside the litter, Sir Osmond was shouting something, and someone was shouting back. The litter jerked to a halt.
"Are you all dead?"
roared Kettle Black.
"Get out of the bloody way!"
The Queen pulled back a corner of the curtain and beckoned to Sir Meron Trant.
"What seems to be the trouble?"
"The sparrows, Your Grace."
Sir Meron wore a white scale armour beneath his cloak. His helm and shield were slung from his saddle.
"Camping in the street. We'll make a move."
"Do that, but gently. I do not care to be caught up in another riot."
Cersei let the curtain fall.
"This is absurd."
"It is, Your Grace," Lady Meriwether agreed. "The High Septon should have come to you, and these wretched sparrows."
"Oh, he feeds them, coddles them, blesses them, yet will not bless the king."
The blessing was an empty ritual, she knew, but rituals and ceremonies had power in the eyes of the ignorant. Aegon the Conqueror himself had dated the start of his realm from the day the High Septon anointed him in Oldtown. "This wretched priest will obey or learn how weak and human he still is."
"Orton says it is the gold he really wants, that he means to withhold his blessing until the crown resumes its payments."
"The Frith will have its gold as soon as we have peace." Septon Talbot and Septon Reynard had been most understanding of her plight, unlike the wretched Bavossi, who had hounded poor Lord Giles so mercilessly that he had taken to his bed, coughing up blood. "We had to have those ships. She could not rely upon the arbour for her navy. The red winds were too close to the trails. She needed her own strength at sea. The Drummonds rising on the river would give her that. Her flagship would dip twice as many oars as King Robert's hammer. Orain had asked her leave to name her Lord Tywin, which Cersei had been pleased to grant. She looked forward to hearing men speak of her father as a she. Another of the ships would be named Sweet Cersei, and would bear a gilded figurehead carved in her likeness, clad in mail and lion helm, with spear in hand. Brave Joffrey, Lady Joanna, and Lioness would follow her out to sea, along with Queen Marjorie, Golden Rose, Lord Renly, Lady Olena, and Princess Marcella. The Queen had made the mistake of telling Tommen he might name the last five. He had actually chosen Moonboy for one. Only when Lord Orain suggested that men might not want to serve on a ship named for a fool, had the boy reluctantly agreed to honour his sister instead. "If this ragged Septon thinks to make me buy Tommen's blessing, he will soon learn better," she told Hyena. The Queen did not intend to truckle to a pack of priests. The litter halted yet again, so suddenly that Cersei jerked. "Oh, this is infuriating!" She leaned out once more and saw that they had reached the top of Visenya's hill. Ahead loomed the great sept of Baelor, with its magnificent dome and seven shining towers, but between her and the marble steps lay a sullen sea of humanity, brown and ragged and unwashed. Sparrows, she thought, sniffing, though no sparrows had ever smelled so rank. Cersei was appalled. Qyburn had brought her reports of their numbers, but hearing about them was one thing and seeing them another. Hundreds were encamped upon the plaza, hundreds more in the gardens. Their cook fires filled the air with smoke and stinks. Rough-spun tents and miserable hovels made of mud and scrap wood besmirched the pristine white marble. They were even huddled on the steps beneath the great sept's towering doors. Sir Osmond came trotting back to her. Beside him rode Sir Osfrid, mounted on a stallion as golden as his cloak. Osfrid was the middle kettle-black, quieter than his siblings, more apt to scowl than smile, and crueler as well, if the tales were true. Perhaps I should have sent him to the wall. Grand Maester Pycelle had wanted an older man, more seasoned in the ways of war, to command the gold cloaks, and several of her other councillors had agreed with him. Sir Osfrid is seasoned quite sufficiently, she had told them, but even that did not shut them up. They yap at me like a pack of small, annoying dogs. Her patience with Pycelle had all but run its course. He had even had the temerity to object to her sending to Dorne for a master-at-arms, on the grounds that it might offend the Tyrells. "Why do you think I'm doing it?" she had asked him scornfully.
"I beg pardon, Your Grace," said Sir Osmond. "My brother is summoning more gold cloaks. We'll clear a pass, never fear."
"I do not have the time. I will continue on afoot."
"Please, Your Grace," Taino caught her arm. "They frighten me. There are hundreds of them, and so dirty."
Cersei kissed her cheek. "The Dian does not fear the Sparrow. But it is good of you to care. I know you love me well, my lady. Sir Osmond kindly helped me down. If I had known I was going to have to walk, I would have dressed for it." She wore a white gown slashed with cloth of gold, lacy but demure. It had been several years since the last time she had donned it, and the Queen found it uncomfortably tight about the middle. "Sir Osmond, Sir Meryn, you will accompany me. Sir Osfrid, see that my litter comes to no harm." Some of the Sparrows looked gaunt and hollow-eyed enough to eat her horses. As she made her way through the ragged throng, past their cook-fires, wagons, and crude shelters, the Queen found herself remembering another crowd that had once gathered on this plaza. The day she wed Robert Baratheon, thousands had turned out to cheer for them. All the women wore their best, and half the men had children on their shoulders. When she had emerged from inside the sept, hand in hand with the young king, the crowd sent up a roar so loud it could be heard in Lannisport.
"They like you well, my lady," Robert whispered in her ear. "See, every face is smiling."
For that one short moment, she had been happy in her marriage, until she chanced to glance at Jamie. "No," she remembered thinking. "Not every face, my lord." No one was smiling now. The looks the Sparrows gave her were dull, sullen, hostile. They made way, but reluctantly. If they were truly Sparrows, a shout would send them flying. 100 gold cloaks with staves and swords and maces could clear this rabble quick enough. That was what Lord Tywin would have done. He would have ridden over them instead of walking through. When she saw what they had done to Baelor the Beloved, the Queen had cause to rue her soft heart. The great marble statue that had smiled serenely over the plaza for 100 years was waist-deep in a heap of bones and skulls. Some of the skulls had scraps of flesh still clinging to them. A crow sat atop one such, enjoying a dry, leathery feast. Flies were everywhere. "What is the meaning of this?" Cersei demanded of the crowd. "Do you mean to bury blessed Baelor in a mountain of carrion?" A one-legged man stepped forward, leaning on a wooden crutch.
"Your Grace, these are the bones of holy men and women, murdered for their faith. Septons, scepters, brothers brown and dun and green, sisters white and blue and grey. Some were hanged, some disemboweled. Septs have been despoiled, maidens and mothers raped by godless men and demon worshippers. Even silent sisters have been molested. The mother above cries out in her anguish. We have brought their bones here from all over the realm to bear witness to the agony of the holy faith."
Cersei could feel the weight of eyes upon her. "The king shall know of these atrocities," she answered solemnly. "Tommen will share your outrage.
This is the work of Stannis and his Red Witch and the savage Northmen who worship trees and wolves. She raised her voice. Good people, your dead shall be avenged.
A few cheered, but only a few.
We ask no vengeance for our dead,
said the one-legged man.
Only protection for the living, for the ships and holy places.
The Iron Tongue must defend the faith,
growled a hulking lout with a seven-pointed star painted on his brow.
A king who does not protect his people is no king at all.
Mutters of assent went up from those around him. One man had the temerity to grasp Sir Merrin by the wrist and say,
It is time for all appointed knights to forsake their worldly masters and defend our holy faith. Stand with us, sir, if you love the seven.
Unhand me, said Sir Merrin, wrenching free.
I hear you, Cersei said. My son is young, but he loves the seven well. You shall have his protection and mine own.
The man with a star upon his brow was not appeased.
The warrior will defend us, he said, not this fat boy king.
Merrin Trant reached for his sword, but Cersei stopped him before he could unsheathe it. She had only two knights amidst a sea of sparrows. She saw staves and scythes, cudgels and clubs, several axes. I will have no blood shed in this holy place, sir. Why are all men such children? Cut him down, and the rest will tear us limb from limb.
We are all the mother's children. Come, his high holiness awaits us.
But as she made her way through the press to the steps of the sept, a gaggle of armed men stepped out to block the doors. They wore mail and boiled leather, with here and there a bit of dinted plate. Some had spears and some had long swords. More favoured axes, and had sewn red stars upon their bleached white surcoats. Two had the insolence to cross their spears and bar her way. "Is this how you receive your queen?" she demanded of them. "Pray, where are Reynard and Torbert?" It was not like those two to miss a chance to fawn on her. Torbert always made a show of getting down on his knees to wash her feet.
"I do not know the men you speak of," said one of the men, with a red star on his surcoat. But if they are of the faith, no doubt the seven had need of their service.
Septon Rhaenar and Septon Torbert are of the most devout, Cersei said, and will be furious to learn that you obstructed me. Do you mean to deny me entrance to Baelor's holy sept?
Your grace,
said a greybeard with a stooped shoulder.
"'Ye are welcome here, but ye men must leave their sword-belts. "'No weapons are allowed within, by command of the High Septon.
"'Knights of the King's Guard do not set aside their swords, "'not even in the presence of the King.
"'In the King's house the King's word must rule,'
replied the aged knight.
"'But this is the House of the Gods.'
"'Colour rose to her cheeks. "'One word to Merrin Trant, and the stoop-backed greybeard would be meeting his guard sooner than he might have liked. Not here, though. Not now.
Wait for me,
she told the king's guard curtly. Alone she climbed the steps. The spearmen uncrossed their spears. Two other men put their weight against the doors, and with a great groan they swung apart. In the Hall of Lamps, Cersei found a score of septons on their knees, but not in prayer. They had pails of soap and water and were scrubbing at the floor. Their rough-spun robes and sandals led Cersei to take them for sparrows, until one raised his head. His face was red as a beet, and there were broken blisters on his hands, bleeding.
Your Grace?
Septon Reynard?
The Queen could scarcely believe what she was seeing.
What are you doing on your knees?
He's cleaning the floor.
The speaker was shorter than the Queen by several inches, and as thin as a broom handle.
Work is a form of prayer, most pleasing to the smith.
He stood, scrub brush in hand.
Your Grace, we have been expecting you.
The man's beard was grey and brown and closely trimmed, his hair tied back in a hard knot behind his head. Though his robes were clean,
They were frayed and patched as well. He had rolled his sleeves up his elbows as he scrubbed, but below the knees the cloths were soaked and sodden. His face was sharply pointed, with deep-set eyes as brown as mud. His feet are bare, she saw with dismay. They were hideous as well, hard and horny things, thick with callus. You are His High Holiness?
We are.
Father, give me strength. The Queen knew that she should kneel, but the floor was wet with soap and dirty water, and she did not wish to ruin her gown. She glanced over at the old men on their knees. I do not see my friend Septon Talbot.
Septon Talbot has been confined to a penitent cell on bread and water. It is sinful for any man to be so plump when half the realm is starving.
Cersei had suffered quite enough for one day. She let him see her anger. Is this how you greet me? With a scrub brush in your hand, dripping water? Do you know who I am?
Your Grace is the Queen Regent of the Seven Kingdoms, the man said. But in the seven-pointed star it is written that as men bow to their lords and lords to their kings, so kings and queens must bow before the seven who are one.
Is he telling me to kneel? If so, he did not know her very well. By rights, you should have met me on the steps in your finest robes with a crystal crown upon your head.
We have no crown, Your Grace.
Her frown deepened. My lord father gave your predecessor a crown of rare beauty, wrought in crystal and spun gold.
And for that gift we honour him in our prayers, the High Septon said. But the poor need food in their bellies more than we need gold and crystal on our head. That crown has been sold. So have the others in our vaults, and all our rings and our robes of cloth of gold and cloth of silver. Wool will keep a man as warm, that is why the seven gave us sheep.
He's utterly mad. The most devout must have been mad as well to elevate this creature, mad or terrified of the beggars at their doors. Kyburn's whisperers claimed that Septon Lucian had been 9 votes from elevation when those doors had given way, and the sparrows came pouring into the great sept with their leader on their shoulders and their axes in their hands. She fixed the small man with an icy stare.
Is there some place where we may speak more privately, Your Holiness?
The High Septon surrendered his scrub brush to one of the most devout.
If Your Grace will follow us.
He led her through the inner doors into the sept proper. Their footsteps echoed off the marble floor. Dust motes swam in the beams of coloured light, slanting down through the leaded glass of the great dome. Incense sweetened the air, and beside the 7 altars, candles shone like stars. 1,000 twinkled for the mother, and near as many for the maid. But you could count the stranger's candles on 2 hands, and still have fingers left. Even here the sparrows had invaded. 12 scruffy hedge knights were kneeling before the warrior, beseeching him to bless the swords they had piled at his feet. At the mother's altar, a septon was leading 100 sparrows in prayer, their voices as distant as waves upon the shore. The High Septon led Cersei to where the crone raised her lantern. When he knelt before the altar, she had no choice but to kneel beside him. Mercifully, this High Septon was not so long-winded as the fat one had been. I should be grateful for that much, I suppose. His High Holiness made no move to rise when his prayer was done. It would seem they must confer upon their knees. A small man's ploy, she thought, amused. High Holiness, she said, these sparrows are frightening the city. I want them gone.
Where should they go, Your Grace?
There are 7 hells. Any one of them will serve. Back where they came from, I would imagine.
They came from everywhere. As the sparrow is the humblest and most common of the birds, they are the humblest and most common of men.
They are common. We agree on that much. Have you seen what they have done to Blessed Baylor's statue?
They befoul the plaza with their pigs and goats and night soil.
Night soil can be washed away more easily than blood, Your Grace. If the plaza was befouled, it was befouled by the execution that was done here. He dares throw Ned Stark in my face.
We all regret that. Joffrey was young, and not as wise as he might have been. Lord Stark should have been beheaded elsewhere, out of respect for blessed Baelor. But the man was a traitor. Let us not forget.
King Baelor forgave those who conspired against him.
King Baelor imprisoned his own sisters, whose only crime was being beautiful.
The first time Cersei heard that tale, she had gone to Tyrion's nursery and pinched the little monster till he cried. I should have pinched his nose shut and stuffed my suck into his mouth. She forced herself to smile.
King Tommen will forgive the sparrows, too, once they have returned to their homes.
Most have lost their homes. Suffering is everywhere, and grief, and death. Before coming to King's Landing, I tended to 50 little villages, too small to have a septum of their own. I walked from each one to the next, performing marriages, absolving sinners of their sins, naming newborn children. Those villages are no more, Your Grace. Weeds and thorns grow where gardens once flourished, and bones litter the roadside.
War is a dreadful thing. These atrocities are the work of the Northmen, and of Lord Stannis and his demon worshippers.
Some of my sparrows speak of bands of lions who despoil them, and of the Hound, who was your own sworn man. At Salt Pans he slew an aged septon and despoiled a girl of 12, an innocent child promised to the faith. He wore his armour as he raped her, and her tender flesh was torn and crushed by his iron mail. When he was done, he gave her to his men, who cut off her nose and nipples.
His Grace cannot be held responsible for the crimes of every man who ever served House Lannister. Sandor Clegane is a traitor and a brute. Why do you think I dismissed him from our service? He fights for the outlaw Beric Dondarrion now, not for King Tommen.
As you say, yet it must be asked, where were the king's knights when these things were being done? Did not Jaehaerys, the conciliator, once swear upon the Iron Throne himself that the crown would always protect and defend the faith?
Cersei had no idea what Jaehaerys, the conciliator, might have sworn.
He did, she agreed, and the High Septon blessed him and anointed him as king. It is traditional for every new High Septon to give the king his blessing.
And yet you have refused to bless King Tommen.
Your Grace is mistaken. We have not refused.
You have not come.
The hour is not yet ripe.
Are you a priest or a greengrocer? And what might I do to make it riper?
If he dares mention gold, I will deal with this one as I did the last, and find a pious 8-year-old to wear the crystal crown.
The realm is full of kings. For the faith to exalt one above the rest, we must be certain. 300 years ago, when Aegon the Dragon landed beneath this very hill, the High Septon looked himself within the starry sept of Oldtown, and prayed for 7 days and 7 nights, taking no nourishment but bread and water. When he emerged, he announced that the faith would not oppose Aegon and his sisters, for the crone had lifted up her lamp to show him what lay ahead. If Oldtown took up arms against the dragon, Oldtown would burn, and the High Tower and the Citadel and the Starry Sept would be cast down and destroyed. Lord Hightower was a godly man. When he heard the prophecy, he kept his strength at home and opened the city gates to Aegon when he came. And his High Holiness anointed the conqueror with the 7 oils. I must do as he did 300 years ago. I must pray and fast. For 7 days and 7 nights, for as long as needs be.
Cersei itched to slap his solemn, pious face. I could help you fast, she thought.
I could shut you up in some tower and see that no one brings you food until the guards have spoken.
These are false kings, Aspas, false gods, she reminded him. Only King Tommen defends the holy faith.
Yet everywhere septs are burned and looted. Even Silent Sisters have been raped, crying their anguish to the sky. Your Grace has seen the bones and skulls of our holy dead.
I have, she had to say. Give Tommen your blessing, and he shall put an end to these outrages.
And how shall he do that, Your Grace? Will he send a knight to walk the roads with every begging brother? Will he give us men to guard our scepters against the wolves and lions?
I will pretend you did not mention lions.
The realm is at war. His Grace has need of every man.
Cersei did not intend to squander Tommen's strength, playing wet nurse to sparrows or guarding the wrinkled cunts of a thousand sour scepters. Half of them are probably praying for a good raping.
Your sparrows have clubs and axes. Let them defend themselves.
Oh, King Maegor's laws prohibit that, as your Grace must know.
It was by his decree that the faith laid down its swords.
Tommen is king now, not Maegor.
What did she care what Maegor the Cool had decreed 300 years ago? Instead of taking the swords out of the hands of the faithful, he should have used them for his own ends. She pointed to where the warrior stood above his altar of red marble.
What is that he holds?
A sword.
Has he forgotten how to use it?
Maegor's laws
could be undone.
She let that hang there, waiting for the high sparrow to rise to the bait. He did not disappoint her.
The faithful militant reborn. That would be the answer to 300 years of prayer, Your Grace. The warrior would lift his shining sword again and cleanse this sinful realm of all its evil. If His Grace were to allow me to restore the ancient blessed orders of the sword and star, every godly man in the Seven Kingdoms would know him to be our true and rightful lord.
That was sweet to hear, but Cersei took care not to seem too eager.
Your High Holiness spoke of forgiveness earlier. In these troubled times, King Tommen would be most grateful if you could see your way to forgiving the crown's debt. It seems to me we owe the faith some 900,000 dragons. 900,674 dragons. Gold that could feed the hungry and rebuild 1,000 septs.
Oh, is it gold you want? The queen asked. Or do you want these dusty laws of Maegor set aside?
The High Septon pondered that a moment.
As you wish. This debt shall be forgiven, and King Tommen will have his blessing. The warrior's sons shall escort me to him, shining in the glory of their faith, while my sparrows go forth to defend the meek and humble of the land, reborn as poor fellows as of old.
The queen got to her feet and smoothed her skirts.
I shall have the papers drawn up, and His Grace will sign them and affix them with the royal seal. If there was one part of kingship that Tommen loved, it was playing with his seal.
Seven save, His Grace, long may reign.
The High Septon made a steeple of his hands and raised his eyes to heaven.
Let the wicked tremble.
Do you hear that, Lord Stannis? Cersei could not help but smile. Even her lord father could have done no better. At a stroke she had rid King's Landing of the plague of sparrows, secured Tommen's blessing, and lessened the crown's debt by close to 1,000,000 dragons. Her heart was soaring as she allowed the High Septon to escort her back to the Hall of Lamps. Lady Merryweather shared the queen's delight, though she had never heard of the warrior's sons or the poor fellows.
They date from before Aegon's conquest,
Cersei explained to her.
The warrior's sons were an order of knights who gave up their lands and gold and swore their swords to His High Holiness. The poor fellows, they were humbler, though far more numerous, begging brothers of a sort, though they carried axes instead of bowls. They wandered the roads escorting travellers from sept to sept and town to town. Their badge was a 7-pointed star
red on white, so the small folk named them stars. The warrior sons wore rainbow cloaks and inlaid silver armour over hair shirts, and bore star-shaped crystals in the pommels of their longswords. They were the swords. Holy men, ascetics, fanatics, sorcerers, dragon slayers, demons.